speculations around this cable and this particular infrastructure. I wrote recently this 100-page thesis around this, if you're interested. So I have a lot of information in my head. I hope I'm not so... that I don't take too long, but yeah, I hope it's interesting. There's a lot of things to talk about in relation to this cable. And I'm now in the process of translating this research into a video essay. Most of my work is video-based, so yeah, that's kind of what I'm doing now. It's a long-term project. So this cable, Atlantis II, was installed in 2000. It's the first submarine cable, as I said, that connected Europe and South America. This year, Ella Link was installed, so now it's not the only one, but it was for 21 years. And one of its 7 landing stations, which I'll show later, is in Conil, a small coastal town in the south of Spain. And it arrives at this bunker that you're seeing here. This is an anti-nuclear bunker that was built in 1970 to protect one of the landing stations of another cable, a telephone cable called the TAT-5 or MAT-1, which connected Mediterranean countries and the United States during the Cold War. And after 2 months of being in Conil and insisting a lot to the people who work here, I was eventually granted access into the bunker. I was not allowed to take pictures or videos or anything inside, so I can't show you the inside. That's going to be part of the film, maybe doing some sort of 3D rendering out of my memory of what I saw. But I wanted to share with you one of the first things that I saw when I walked inside the bunker, which is this framed bronze plaque featuring a relief of the Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, and United States flag connected by this meandering cable, which commemorated the laying of this cable, the TAT-5 and the MAT-1, in 1970. And in the background, you can see yet this other relief that depicts 3 ships with crosses on their sails, most likely referring to the 3 caravels used by Columbus when he first sailed to America, La Pinta, La Niña, and La Santa Maria. So I was really struck by this institutional image because I thought it just clearly inserted submarine cables into a genealogy originating from the European colonization of America, establishing a very evident and obvious relation between colonial and digital transatlantic infrastructures. So kind of like taking this image as a starting point, I want to like weave now some sort of speculations around the internet's infrastructure and what I found there. Before I dive into these questions, I wanted to make a brief like methodological note. So the way I approach technology is, you know, I think the connections between technology and reality are always layered and multiple. A network that goes back in time and tends to be obscured by distance. And in order to elucidate these complexities, I think that nonlinear speculative interpretation is a better equipped methodology to plot this material and semiotic relations in the internet's infrastructure. And so even though speculation can refer to many things like foretelling the future and economic investments or active contemplation, the way I refer to it is as a creative act of making conjectures based on the connection between different elements that are seemingly disparate. I also think that the imaginative quality of speculative interpretation is very tied to the act of storytelling. So you'll see that a lot of what I talk about here is related to science fiction and storytelling, which I think allows us to open new vantage points to trace patterns that differ from those that have already been established. And I also am interested in that this act of speculative and interpretive storytelling is also really tied to nonlinear thinking, an approach that I'm really inspired by Denise Ferreira da Silva's work, which seeks to shed light on the correspondences between different occurrences across time and space. So these are some screenshots of interviews I conducted while I was there. Most of them are people from Conil that I met there. It's a fisherman's town, so there's a lot of fishing people involved here, teachers, marine geologist. She works in telegeography for the Latin American division. She's from Peru, and we met through Skype. And I was really interested in a lot of the stories that these people told me about the infrastructure of the internet, which were always tied to science fiction, because a lot of the people who live in Conil, even though they've lived around this infrastructure, they don't really have access to it. So their way to relate to it is through this imaginative qualities, which I think are really interested in because it helps them sort of dislocate the present into the future, into these more imaginative places, and kind of like revise the present through a more critical lens. And the interesting thing also is that they're not just making the science fiction stories about the bunker and what's inside the bunker. You know, there's stories about aliens and like things that are, they think that are being kept hidden from them inside the bunker. But actually a lot of them, like this guy, Diego Tirado, who's a fisherman from this town, actually was hired by the company in 2000 to lay the cable on the beach. So a lot of these people in Conil have also this relation to the infrastructure mediated by labor, which I was also really interested in. Actually also José Ligero, his father was a fisherman in the region, and every time that a boat of Telefónica, which is the company that owns the infrastructure, would go to Conil, his father would be the only one capable of helping them find the cable undersea, because the company would take like, could take years, not years, sorry, weeks to find it, because of course the tide moves it around. So the company really relies on the knowledge of the people who live there, and on people who are really seafaring people. So I thought those, all those relations were really interesting as well. So a lot of the things I'm gonna share with you emerged from a lot of these conversations also that I had with them. There was a lot of like ethnographic work that I did and autoethnographic work that I did, which you'll see as well. And I just wanted to briefly address this idea of science fiction, because I think that Telefónica, the company, is very much aware of this science fiction narrative built around the internet infrastructure, and they directly address it through opposing it with a message of technology as a fact, right? And that was really clear to me in this video. I'll show you just a piece of this video so you see what I'm talking about. This is a promotional video of Telefónica. Oh, I don't know if the sound, okay.
Brasil, el quinto país más grande del mundo. Con más de 200 millones de habitantes, es el estado de América Latina con más usuarios de Internet. Un motor fundamental del crecimiento exponencial del tráfico de datos en la región. Pero, ¿por dónde viajan esos datos? Son las 5:30 de la mañana en la Praia do Futuro, en la ciudad de Fortaleza, al nordeste de Brasil. Un cable submarino de más de 11.000 kilómetros está a punto de amarrar en esta playa.
Estamos aquí para asistir a la llegada de Brusa en Fortaleza, Brasil. Brusa es un sistema de cable submarino que conectará Brasil con Estados Unidos. Va a permitir que todas las zonas de su recorrido tengan las condiciones necesarias para comunicarse durante los próximos 25 años a alta velocidad, con una enorme capacidad y que todo esté compartido, todo esté conectado, todas las personas puedan comunicarse en esta nueva era digital.
Right, so the introduction of this video is a lot, of course, about this fiction of like frictionless connectivity around the world, even though they're talking about infrastructure. And I was interested also how they mentioned this beach in Brazil is called Future, the Future Beach, kind of like the future land here in the port. There's a lot of future things happening with the internet always and the infrastructure. And now they're going to mention here more the science fiction that I was talking about.
Cables como Marea y Brusa nos permiten decir que el futuro ya está aquí. Son cables de última generación. La importancia de estos nuevos cables submarinos de última generación es procurar una mayor satisfacción de nuestros clientes. Es procurar atender las exigencias de nuestros clientes del cloud computing, del Internet de las cosas, de los sistemas financieros. Por ello, estamos siempre evolucionando para atender mejor las exigencias de nuestros clientes en el día a día. Con cables submarinos de última generación como Brusa y Marea, estamos listos para conectarnos con el futuro.
Las playas de Brasil son sin duda de las más concurridas del planeta. Pocos de los que las frecuentan saben que bajo ellas viaja un flujo de información que nos conecta. Y desde ahora, gracias a Brusa, los visitantes de esta playa estarán más conectados con el futuro. No es ciencia ficción, es simplemente tecnología.
Right, so there's all of this thing about being connected to the future, like this temporal displacement about that signify internet cables, you know, like simultaneity around the world. But also I was this part of like, it's not science fiction, it's just technology. I thought just was really interesting how this video creates this tension between science fiction and technology, the meaning, storytelling as a meaning-making tool around the internet's infrastructure and instead solidifying this myth of technology as an objective truth. But I think that really what they're doing is kind of creating their own science fiction, right? A science fiction that is about reclaiming the ownership of the narrative as a multinational corporate company. And it's a science fiction about cables connecting us to the future. So I think this is a really fucked up way of just like displacing maybe more local knowledge around these infrastructures. So after this brief sort of introduction around science fiction and why I think it's so important, now I want to share with you a little bit of what I found in this place. So you can see here Conil de la Frontera. This is the south of Spain, this is Gibraltar, and this is Morocco. And in Conil de la Frontera, where Atlantis II lands, is located in the region of Cádiz. Here is Cádiz in Spain, which is the region of Andalusia, the community of Andalusia. And this region that stretches from the Gibraltar Strait all the way to Portugal was in ancient like Greek and Roman times considered like the frontier of Europe, right? The frontier of the westernmost frontier of Europe. According to Greek and Roman mythology, the two mountains that frame the Gibraltar Strait were known as the Pillars of Heracles, and it was believed that the ancient hero Hercules or Heracles had inscribed a message in the two rocks, non plus ultra, which in Latin implies that there is nothing beyond, right? It was this like imagination of the edge of the world. And the Pillars of Heracles, they both guarded, they connected two bodies of water, the Atlantic and the Mediterranean, but they also protected the edges of the Mediterranean world. So they were kind of like a passageway and a frontier at the same time, which is something that I'm really interested in, this double work of frontier and passageway. But during the early years of the Spanish colonization of America, Cádiz, this region became one of the most important seaports for the Spanish Empire. And during the 16th century, the Spanish King and Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, who commissioned Magellan's voyage around the world, transformed that ancient motto of non plus ultra into plus ultra, which in Latin implies that there is more beyond. So this reformulation of the Atlantic Ocean from a frontier to a medium of connectivity is today inscribed still in the Spanish coat of arms, which depicts that emblem of plus ultra above the two pillars of Heracles and above the ocean. And so I'm interested that if the sea was the frontier of like the pre-modern Western world, in early modernity, in early colonial modernity, the Atlantic became more like the connecting axis of empire building. And I think the cable, Atlantis II, which you can see here, the voyage it takes, is deeply connected to this history and this transformation of the Atlantic Ocean as a connecting axis. So most of the seven landing sites of Atlantis either overlap exactly or are very close to some of the most important seaports of Spanish and Portuguese triangular commerce, which was this transatlantic system designed to secure the extraction of enslaved human labor from West Africa, the extraction of minerals and raw materials from South America, and the manufacturing of these materials into consumer goods in Europe, which is pretty much how the world order still operates with some variations. So you can see here there's a landing site in Portugal, in Carcavelos, close to Lisbon. Then there's Conil. Then this is the Canary Islands. Then this is Cape Verde, Praia. then this is Dakar in Senegal, and then this is Fortaleza in Brazil, where we saw the video. They were talking about Fortaleza, and this is Las Toninas, really close to Buenos Aires in Argentina. And many of these seaports that you're looking at were also crucial for Magellan's voyage in 1519, which was sponsored by the Spanish Crown and was the first one that circumnavigated the entire world for the first time. So I also think that there's something about this route that is really historically deeply tied to this idea of connecting the world, right? This colonial act of connectivity for trade and commerce is kind of like in the part of the genealogy of this cable. And this voyage of Magellan was what kind of originated this age of discovery, or so-called age of discovery, really, which was like the colonial exploitation of the entire world. And you can see this, that, I mean, what I'm trying to say here with new infrastructure being built upon older infrastructure is kind of like the dynamic of a lot of the internet's material infrastructure. There's always something that acts as the base. Actually, one book that Dennis brought here called by Shannon Mattern, I forget the name of the book, talks a lot about this, right? About the layering of material infrastructure. And so even though the South Atlantic, which is this whole region, was very active during colonial times, when the British and the Dutch displaced the Portuguese and Spanish hegemony of colonial dominance over the world and trading routes, the North Atlantic was consolidated more as like a more active region of commerce. And you can see that reflected in the amount of cables that cross the North Atlantic. They are like 100 times more than the ones that connect the South Atlantic, which is also very telling of these configurations. Actually, South America is much more connected to the US. Data travels much more quickly and typically from South America to the US and then to Europe. So these cables, they attempt to reduce redundancy, to augment redundancy and reduce latency, like the speed at which data travels. And they serve a lot both for the financial market, where like a millisecond makes a huge difference in a transactional, in a like bank transaction or like stocks, but also for gamers. It's like a big thing, you know, if you're playing games and you shoot someone, you want your shot to get a millisecond before the other person to win the game. And this is a... this is a place I visited in Sevilla. This is Sevilla, also in Andalusia, and this is a replica of the boat that Magellan used in 1519 to go around the world. It's called La Nao Victoria. And it's a really crazy place because they make no mention whatsoever to colonial history. It's all about like the amazing journey of connecting the entire world. So I also shot some images here and kind of like secretly took a camera inside and shot like all of these depictions. I don't have the footage here now to show you. But so coming back to Conil, which is here, I was really interested in trying to map like all of these infrastructures that I met, that I saw while I was there. So the squares are watchtowers, which I'll tell you a little bit more what they were used for. Very old 500, 700, 800 year old watchtowers. Then Spanish Civil War bunkers, or bunkers also from World War II. Then the submarine cable bunker, you can see it here in the star. And then the circle is a submarine cable manhole, which I'll show you also a little bit later on. So the watchtowers, there's a bunch of watchtowers in the coast of Cádiz, and they were built during the 800-year war between Islamic kingdoms and caliphates and the Catholic kingdoms of Spain. I don't know how much you know about this history, but the Iberian Peninsula was pretty much like part of the Islamic different caliphates. It was not like a consolidated empire, but it was like the Umayyad Empire, los Omeyas, who were there for nearly 800 years. So Conil is actually called Conil de la Frontera, Conil of the Frontier. A lot of cities in this region of Spain have this name to allude to this constant oscillation of the frontier, this contested geopolitical space between like Islam and Catholicism. Pretty much like the formation of modern Europe was happening in this place. And these wars ended in 1492 when the Spanish Catholic kings Ferdinand and Isabel conquered Granada, which was the same year that Columbus arrived in America. So this year really can be, we can think about it as like the year where what we think of as modern Catholic Europe as a capitalist colonial formation was really sort of consolidated, at least in this part of the world, in its westernmost frontier. And these towers, interestingly enough, were also used for spotting tuna in the ocean, which is one of the main economic activities, even until today, since the time of the Phoenicians in this region of the world. So I was also interested in this double use of infrastructures, which is also present still today in internet infrastructures. This tower is also really interesting today because there's a nearly extinct species of bird called Ibis eremita. It was thought to be extinct, a Mediterranean bird, and actually this tower became home of the only known family of Ibis eremita today registered in the world. So I also think it's interesting to think how ruins or infrastructural ruins become repurposed by humans and non-humans alike and create these layers of meaning and of use. And you see this one in like ruins, but Conil over the last maybe like 20, 30 years has been becoming like most of that coast of Spain into a really popular touristic destination. So yeah, I think there's also a lot there, which I'm not gonna go too deep right now into, of how like speculation, like housing speculation, touristic speculation is affecting a lot of the understanding around these ruins and these infrastructures. And then this is a picture of one of the many Spanish Civil War bunkers. So these are very interesting because these bunkers were built by Franco, the Spanish dictator, and with the help of Hitler during, before and during World War II, because Hitler was really paranoid that the Allies and the US would land through Spain in order to defeat him. That was kind of like one of the most obvious landing spots because of its proximity to the US. That never happened. So these bunkers were never really used, and the whole coast of Cádiz is like filled with these bunkers. So they kind of like became ruins pretty quickly after they were built, kind of like automatic ruins. And this is another, this is a tower called an almenara, which is like in Spanish, a lot of words coming from Arabic. It's a watchtower, a military watchtower that was built by an Islamic, the Islamic Kingdom that was here at the time. And now it's converted into a lighthouse. And right next to it, there's three telecommunication towers. So there's a lot of these like infrastructural layering of historical infrastructures that were designed to like protect and secure a contested geopolitical frontier. And I feel that the internet, with this language of anti-nuclear bunkers and this sort of military infrastructure, has continued this narrative and this practice of sort of like securing this space as a strategic geopolitical space. And that is why most people told me that's why the internet bunker was built there in the first place, and why Conil is such a strategic place for the internet, because of its proximity to America, but also because of this very deep history of contested geopolitical frontiers, and specifically with the Arab world, right? And that's something that when you go to the south of Spain, you realize that even though this frontier has been like solidified over the years, there's still a lot of connection and contact across the border. You know, there's, you can see it in the architecture, in the food, in language, but also through immigration. Actually, when I was there, there was this crazy refugee crisis. 8,000 refugees in Morocco were led into Ceuta and Melilla, which are two post-colonial enclaves of Spain in the north of Morocco. Like you can see here, Spain has the tip of Morocco still nowadays, and that's a heavy place also of internet communication. And Morocco, in retaliation for some weird complex power play, just opened the doors here for 8,000 refugees to enter. So you know, I'm interested, and I go very deep into how I see these relations between frontiers, immigration, and internet infrastructure. And this is kind of like the last infrastructure that I wanted to share with you that I found there, which is the manhole. So this is pretty much like just randomly there in the beach of Conil. And this is where the cable that comes from the ocean meets the cable that goes underground into the bunker. You know, and I visited this place so many times. I did different things here. I did like a tarot reading here. I did another thing that I'll show you later on, a collaboration with my yoga teacher there and also a flamenco dancer. But I always thought, like, you know, if I had the right tools, I could totally open this thing and just mess around with it. I didn't do it, but, you know, it's just there. There's no security around this place at all. Which I think is also interesting, because I think they assume the security comes from being underground, kind of like hidden behind these bushes and into the river. But of course, the ocean has completely eroded the structure over the last 20 years. So this is the collaboration I told you I did with Patricia Peces, who is this professional flamenco dancer. And I don't know, I thought it was interesting that, you know, it's a heavily touristy town, a lot of people surf here. I was also learning a little bit how to surf, which was really interesting. So she's wearing a wetsuit and then typical flamenco shoes and the fan and the peineta, the hair thing. And she's dancing to a song which is called A Colombiana, a Colombian rhythm of flamenco, which was something I didn't know about. I found out about this rhythm when I was there. And basically, as I was telling you, this region of Spain has always been very deeply connected to the Caribbean and to South America. And there's a lot of exchange, culturally speaking, colonially speaking, trading, etc. And there's this particular rhythms of flamenco called cantes de ida y vuelta, like the songs of coming and going. And one of them is called La Colombiana. It's a rhythm that is deeply influenced by Colombian Afro-Caribbean rhythms. So she's dancing to A Colombiana on top of the manhole, which I thought was like an interesting gesture, ritual, something to resignify this heavy space of surveillance and data capitalism, basically. And I also found out when I was there that my last name, Pacheco, is very associated to Roma communities there, to Gitanos, like gypsies living in this area, who are also the main people who sing flamenco in the south of Spain. So there were many connections there that I thought were interesting to explore through this collaboration. So that's kind of like an overview of the things I saw, these infrastructures I saw. And then the other part of my research focused more on the name of this cable, Atlantis. So kind of like bearing in mind all of these infrastructures that I saw, I wanted to like maybe address the cable through its name and think about how could I construct my own mythology, bearing in mind that Atlantis, of course, refers to the mythological city of Atlantis, taking into account all of these colonial and military infrastructures. So the purpose of this story that I kind of like I'm in the process also of creating is to highlight what Starr and Bowker have already pointed out when they refer to the importance of metaphors that we use to think through technology. Infrastructural metaphors bring certain aspects of technology to light while simultaneously hiding others from view, and upon close examination, I think they reveal aspects of technology that we might often take for granted. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit now about Atlantis and how I'm piecing together this story. So Atlantis too is named after the mythological city of Atlantis, which was first mentioned by Plato as a technologically advanced island that stretched just from outside of the pillars of Heracles, that you can see here, to the mainland of the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. It was like this imagined mainland. And even if Atlantis was just an allegory, which is the typical interpretation made by scholars today, its emphasis on transoceanic connectivity is really what has been sort of remembered by many. So for example, Kircher, Athanasius Kircher, this German philosopher, scientist, whatever, person from 1678, depicted Atlantis in this drawing, in this really interesting drawing of the world upside down. And he depicted it as this huge island in the middle of the Atlantic. So I started thinking, like, what if Atlantis too is kind of like the continuation of this mythological city, inheriting both the might of the Atlantean civilization and also the tragedy of the Atlantean civilization. So Atlantis, according to Plato, had a lot of wealth and technological advances. But despite of this, the city was susceptible to the forces of its material and environmental surroundings. In the dialogues of Critias and Timaeus, Plato tells us that Atlantis was shaken by earthquakes and floods in the course of a single day until the entire island sank beneath the sea and vanished. So I think the fragility of Atlantis is reminiscent to me of the fragility of the internet's undersea infrastructure, which are composed of these cables that are subject to geological forces, as well to ship anchors and fishing boats. They get broken up every time by these kind of like human and geological forces. There's around 100 reported failures of cables a year, even though there's many more that go unreported. And in fact, Atlantis too suffered this damages, heavy damages due to infrastructural work done for the Olympic Games of Brazil in 2015, and they were detected in Spain. So I think, yeah, it's interesting for me to think about the internet infrastructure as a fragile space, just as Atlantis could have been thousands of years ago. And submarine cables, they don't last forever either. You know, they have an approximate life expectancy of 20 to 25 years. And when they can't be used or reused or fixed anymore, they are typically just turned off and left in the ocean floor because it's really expensive to take them out. However, sometimes cables are repurposed to create other connections, or they become recycled infrastructure for other species to dwell in, kind of similar to this tower I was talking about with the birds. So Nicole Starosielski, in her really amazing book, The Undersea Network, talks about the Ocean City Reef Foundation's cable wire reef off the coast of Maryland in the US. So pretty much this was AT&T depositing a bunch of old submarine fiber optic cables, and they created this reef based on like this cable trash. And apparently, according to them, I'm not exactly sure if this is true or not, it has been very successful as a project for undersea reefs. And similarly, I thought about these experiments that Microsoft is doing recently of putting data centers underwater, trying to harness the energy of currents and tides and also just the temperature of water to cool data centers off. This is off the coast of Scotland in the Orkney Islands. And after 2 years of being sunk underwater, only 2 years when they took it out, it was covered in barnacles, algae, anemones. So in other words, I'm interested in how this, you know, when anthropogenic technology becomes a submarine ruin, such as maybe even sunk colonial galleons or ruins of ancient civilizations or technological infrastructure, they become this home for other lives in addition to kind of new geological layers under the ocean floor. And I think that thinking about the internet infrastructure as this material phenomenon linked to like maybe more geological cycle of media, it's interesting because it allows us also to challenge this nature-culture divide that characterizes the way we understand the internet as an ethereal phenomenon. And I think it also increases our capacity of being aware of the ecological impacts of technology. So Plato also said that the city of Atlantis depended on the advanced extraction of minerals in order to power their technology. And one of the reasons he says that they were doomed to collapse was because even though they were very prosperous and they had all this technological prowess, it was punished by the gods because of their greed and corruption. So I think this tragic story of Atlantis speaks a lot also, or can speak a lot about also about how we relate today to our technological infrastructures, in particular the internet. This story also inspired Francis Bacon in 1626 to write this utopian novel, a fiction novel called The New Atlantis, which was this utopian narrative that imagined a future society where scientific knowledge was organized to produce wealth and welfare, reflecting, of course, the trust that early modernity placed on technoscience and rationalism, which we still inherit today. But I think it was really interesting for me reading that book, because at a point Bacon mentions that Atlantis is just another name for America, and points towards the ancient might of Amerindian civilizations. So I think this convergence of like myth and colonial history during the European colonization of America shows that, I think it shows that the story of Atlantis was revived in the Renaissance to try to make sense of this new world order marked by colonialism and Western globalization and the destruction of indigenous civilizations as a pursuit of global technology. So I think if Atlantis was the antithesis of Athens during the time of Plato, I think we can think of Atlantis today as a cautionary tale, like kind of like telling us of the things that can happen based on these global utopias guided by technological development. This is a picture of another museum I visited, which has a replica of the three caravels used by Columbus, the same ones that you saw in the Bronze Plague. It's a crazy museum. I have a lot of footage from here. They have like a replica of the indigenous people in the first island that they landed. It's really fucked up, and they say that they were living in the Stone Age, and this is like a museum still active today. So I think that, you know, the impending growth of the internet, which has been clearly accelerated by the pandemic that we have been living over the last year and a half, 2 years, I think it calls for more critical and also interdisciplinary and nonlinear research on all of this historical material and narrative relations embedded in submarine cables. And as we keep facing, you know, social and environmental catastrophe, I want to propose that Atlantis too can be a cautionary tale for us. You know, if the lost city of Atlantis was doomed to flood because of its misuse of resources and technology, I ask myself, will our increasingly digitized world face the same future because of the destabilization of the biosphere ushered by our extractive technologies? When the climate crisis brings upon us the inevitable flooding of coastal areas, will the internet's cable stations and data centers be sunk underneath the sea just like Atlantis once was? Atlantis II, the first internet cable that connected Europe and South America, will probably be remembered as the lost echelon of the lost city of Atlantis. Whether the ruins of the internet will become coral reefs or nesting grounds for humans as an endangered species, I think still remains to be seen. But I believe that if we plot these deep connections between coloniality and mythology and submarine cables, we can imagine new and maybe better ways of relating to the internet as a fragile ecosystem to care for. And so these are some of the stills from few of the images that I have that will hopefully become a film in the future. And yeah, maybe just to kind of like close, I think that there's something that I think it's really important about thinking about these metaphors beyond just a poetic level of interpretation. Also, just to think about the way we relate with our own systems of knowledge to this infrastructure that is here probably to stay for a long time. What do we make of it, and how do we relate to it? So I'm just gonna quickly show you, I put together something really quick here with some of the images, and show you a little bit of what I did with Patricia. We're not gonna watch it all, just like a brief section of this.
Bye.
anyway, that goes on for a long time. But pretty much the song talks about like this woman that goes to Colombia and meets this mulata, this mestizo woman, and learns to sing this song from her. And she met her eating mangoes in Colombia. And yeah, the song is more, the lyrics speak about this. I don't know if this is how it's going to look at the end. I just put together this morning to show you. But yeah, that's it. Thank you.